My first grade teacher, Miss Caroline, discovered that I was literate and looked at me with more than faint distaste. She told me to tell my father not to teach me anymore. It would interfere with my reading. I mumbled that I was sorry and retired, meditating upon my crime. I never deliberately learned to read, but somehow I had been wallowing illicitly in it. Reading was something that just came to me. Until I feared I would lose it, I never loved to read. One does not love breathing. In Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird, Scout gets scolded for knowing how to read before being taught in school. But what about the millions of American school children who are failing to learn to read, both in school and at home? I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. Arguments over how best to teach children to read have been raging for decades, leading to the phrase, the reading wars. Joining me to explore beyond the reading wars to the science of reading is Mark Seidenberg, UW-Vilas Professor of Psychology, a cognitive neuroscientist, and the author of Language at the Speed of Sight, How We Read, Why So Many Can't, and What Can Be Done About It, hailed by the New York Times as an important and alarming book. Welcome to University of the Year.
Thanks for having me, Emily.
This is a huge topic, reading and the problems of learning to read. I guess I was startled after reading your book about how large a percentage of American adults and children cannot read.
Yes, it's really sobering when you actually look at the data about that, which extend back many decades. We're not talking about recent developments. These things have been pretty consistent for a long time.
And I'm just curious, before we get to some of those statistics and the causes and what we can do about it, what brought you into this field, studying how we learn to read and what the data would suggest compared to how it's being taught?
You know, the field that I'm in has been known under a variety of names over the years. I'm interested in language, human language, how people acquire it, how people use it. And, you know, reading is one form of language, so spoken language, written language, sign languages. I'm interested in all of that. And for most of my career, I studied, well, how does language work? How do children acquire language? It's quite amazing that they do and the way they do it. Perhaps as I reached a certain age, or maybe simply because the concern had just accumulated over the years, I began to feel really uncomfortable about the disconnection between what we had learned from research on language and reading and other topics like how children learn and so on, and what was actually being done in schools, particularly in how kids were being taught to read. So there was a disconnect between the two, and I thought, if we want to improve literacy outcomes, if we want to have more people who can read better, let's try to incorporate more of what we've learned from research. And so I began to get interested in that.
You talk in your book about how schools of education, you write, schools of education don't get no respect. That unlike the situation where medical schools have the sort of cutting edge research on whatever the disease is or the condition that's being treated, that there is, like you say, a disconnect between a school of education and then what's actually done in the classroom. And you talk about how K through 12 teaching is a low status profession in this country, and that teaching teachers can be seen as the lowest of the low. Why do you think that is?
Well, the disconnection is between what happens in the schools of education and how educational professionals like teachers and principals and others are taught, and research. It's not between them and the classrooms per se. Why is there a disconnection between what they're taught and the culture over in the education side and this kind of research? I talked about this in my book quite a lot. The history of schools of education in this country is fascinating. And there were battles over their creation in the early 20th century. Some schools tried them out and decided that this wasn't going to be something that fit with their academic mission, mainly because, you know, it wasn't seen that there was any rigor to the study of education. And so schools of education decided it wasn't something they – some universities decided it was something they just didn't want to invest in. Over a 100-year or so year period, schools of education developed their own sort of culture. And basic research didn't play a very important role in it. Occasionally people would look at it if it They could find research that was consistent with their beliefs, but there was no history of incorporating basic research on things like how children learn into what we should teach teachers, prospective teachers, about how children learn and what kinds of materials we should develop to, in order to promote children's learning. So there's just no history of this dating back over a very long period of time. And it was due to wars that occurred, turf wars on campus that occurred when the schools of education first were introduced in this country and it's continued.
And if I think back on having raised three children and now have three grandchildren, it seems as if with the public schools there have been fads and trends, and you'll hear a phrase like the new math or this or that, so that there seem to be these trends in education that, and I gather from your book in terms of the approach to reading, it's not always grounded in the evidence from research in a lab, that it's sort of theories and attempts to do something, but not necessarily backed up with data. I have a question about the scope of the problem. I've seen kind of a range of figures, but some of the figures suggest that, 2/3 of American children are not proficient at reading by the time they hit fourth grade, or a third can't read at all. I've seen 92% of black children by third grade can't read. I've seen figures that almost half of American adults are not reading at a proficient level. Is that accurate? That seems astounding.
Yeah, it's accurate. How can you tell if someone's a good reader or not? Well, you have to do some kind of assessment. And there are a variety of ones. The most interesting ones are ones like the NAEP, which is done on a representative sample of kids from all 50 states. And it's just supposed to be, the nation's report card. So it's just supposed to be information as opposed to assessments that are used to place children. It's not that kind of thing. It's just to get the information. Who's doing well? Who's not doing well? Can we figure out where we need to direct our resources in order to improve things and so on? So the data from those kinds of assessments, the NAEP is one and there are some others, have been consistent over a many decade period, certainly since the early 90s when some of these testing large-scale assessment report card methods got established. Until the pandemic, the picture was not changing very much. There were large numbers of kids in fourth grade and ninth grade, and kids were assessed at different ages and different tests. But the results were very consistent. There's always a very large percentage of kids who are performing at the lowest levels on these exams. And the numbers are, on the order of 50%. These data have been around for a long time, and people would say, well, the tests aren't accurate for my children, or the cutoffs are put in the wrong places. We can improve everybody's reading if we just change the cutoffs on how the, data from these assessments are graded. But that misses the point. These assessments aren't perfect, but they're very good at what they do. And where you put the exact cutoff between, a basic reader and a more proficient reader isn't actually going to change things very much. There's a very large percentage of kids whose reading, it's not that they can't read anything. It's that their reading is at a very low level that's not going to support them being able to do a lot of things like apply for jobs or perform on certain kinds of jobs or many kinds of jobs or manage their own health care by understanding instructions for medications, for example. Another pernicious thing that happens is someone goes through the system, doesn't acquire very high-level literacy skills, and then they become an adult and a parent. And their own low literacy skills make it so they can't really help their children acquire the skills that they lack. So it's been going on a long time. It can't be blamed on written off as an artifact of how the tests are done. There's too much converging evidence from different sources, including, business organizations that say they can't hire enough people who have reading and writing and speaking skills that allow them to perform, for example, in lots of corporate positions. So the evidence is too consistent over too long a period of time for us to quibble about, what the exact percentage is. We know there are many kids who are not acquiring much in the way of reading and writing skills, and it's been going on a long time.
And I get the sense that there are a lot of adults who are illiterate or close to illiterate who are hiding that fact and have found coping mechanisms so that the true number of adults out there that are not reading well may be higher than we think. I wanted to share a passage with you. This is from a student in my UW Odyssey Project class who wrote about her father. My dad could hardly read or write. When he went to the grocery store, he looked at the picture on the can of what he thought was corned beef hash. When my mom arrived home from work, she went to the trash can and screamed at my dad, "You fool! You gave my children dog food with your no-reading ass." It goes without saying that he was not asked to go shopping for groceries again. My dad only went to school until the third grade because he had to work in the fields. He told his children that education was the key to freedom. We ate dog food, but we were rich.
Well, you know, that passage raises several of interconnected issues here. One is there are people who we haven't reached, I would say the system has failed, who enter into adulthood and live productive lives and somehow manage to cope. And those are people we can admire. However, we shouldn't have been putting them in that position. So one can admire the people who have low literacy skills and understand that it's not because they are unintelligent or anything else. It's because they didn't learn to read and probably would have learned to read if we had been more effective at how we taught them.
And if the world had been more just. In other words, if you have people living in poverty who have to drop out of school to make a living and are sort of written out of the system, they're not given the same opportunities.
Yeah, indeed. So, you know, one of the things I think it's important, there's a lot of discussion right now about moving forward and changing things so that we do better in the future. I am all for that. And a lot of that is people like me will say, well, one thing we can do is we can incorporate more of what we know about how reading works and how language works and how children learn, and we could do a better job in the classroom. It should go without saying, but I have to say it. Yes, we could improve outcomes if we did a better job in the classroom, but we're not talking about addressing homelessness here or a child who's not learning to read because they're not in school regularly. Or we're not addressing lead poisoning from the paint, issues which will affect reading. Mm-hmm. Of course, children struggle in schools for a wide variety of reasons. One of the things we're trying to deal with is something that we can deal with, which is, look, let's at least make this classroom experience as good as it can be so that children can get as far as they can while we're working on these other issues that clearly do have an important impact.
So if you look at children who seem to just find their way to reading, like Scout in To Kill a Mockingbird, who somehow, you know, she's looking at the newspapers her father's reading and she learns to read without really thinking about how and then gets scolded in school because she knows how to read before it's taught. There are children who learn to read and it comes easily and they're proficient.
Well, one thing we should say is there are some children who are going to learn to read regardless of what happens in school. It doesn't matter for those children what happens in school. Why? Well, they may have some benefits coming from the home environment. There may be not just books in the home, but a grandmother who's spending large amounts of time reading with a child, not just reading with them, but pointing out things about how the written code works. You know, so there are some kids for whom how reading is taught, you know, is not crucial because they may come to school already reading, you know, already on their way to reading. But there's a huge number of children for whom it matters a great deal, especially kids who don't have those kind of resources in the home. They might not have a parent or a grandparent or other caregiver who speaks the language or is proficient in the language of the school or are themselves proficient readers. They may not have the resources in the home and the community that are in effect substituting for instruction, obviating, you know, the school in a sense. So here's the here's the unfortunate bottom line. How well we do in public education in the classroom matters most for the kids who have the least resources in the home and community. For the kids who are better off, who have highly educated parents, who have parents who have the time and or to provide basic sort of literacy education to the kid, or outsource it to a, you know, tutor or learning center. For those people, look, the rich get richer. They're going to do fine regardless of what happens in the school. The place where it matters the most, of course, is the kid who, children who don't have access to those resources. And if we do a poor job with, in the classroom, who are we hurting most? Those kids. I strongly believe that the practices that we're using now, the ones that really have been part of the fabric of how teachers view reading and how to teach reading, they are just exacerbating differences in due to SES, due to, you know, resources, inequities in terms of availability of resources in the home and community. We are magnifying those things by the way that we teach reading.
One radio program that I did in the past was with Dr. Dipesh Navarro with the Reach Out and Read program to try to get physicians, pediatricians, to prescribe reading and to give books at checkups and to stress the importance of books in the home. I've also seen reports that the amount of spoken language, the number of vocabulary words from birth through age three, is one of the biggest predictors of success in school. You know, the Providence, Rhode Island program, where they actually recorded the amount of language that was being spoken in the home and looked at predictors of success in school. I'm curious about what you have found in terms of the relationship between spoken language in the home and success with reading.
So these are extremely important issues that you're raising. So let's deal with the reading to children in the home and then spoken language in the home. So we're talking about events that occur before the kid shows up in school. One thing that's important to note is that there are differences, important differences, between children in terms of their readiness to read or their ability to benefit from instruction on the first day of kindergarten. We already know that there are children who are way more ready and way more advanced, way more on the path to be being readers than other kids on the first day of school. So from the start of schooling, there are kids who are ahead. There are kids who are behind. So if there are these differences on the first day of school, that says, well, maybe we should be looking at what happens before they go to school. There's two things. One is in America, we have this mantra that reading to kids is really important, and it is. You know, so you want to read to kids. Sometimes it's called shared reading because it's not just reading to kids; it's engaging with kids over books while you're in the course of reading, and that is important. I don't want to create any confusion about that. However, just reading to kids isn't sufficient for them to learn to read. So, you know, reading to kids is important for a variety of reasons, but it very rarely involves teaching the kids about the things that are really important for reading, like how the code works and how the letters combine and what the letters represent and various things about how print relates to spoken language. You know, when you're reading with a kid, you're reading for the personal interaction, for the communication that's going on, for the enjoyment of the story. You are teaching the kid a lot of things. You could be teaching them vocabulary. You could be teaching them things about how the world works. There's all sorts of benefits to reading to children. However, it doesn't usually, it's not tantamount to teaching a kid to read. So the first thing is reading to kids is important, but it's not sufficient. Now, there are kids who come to school already on track. They can read words. They can start to sound out words. They're doing all these things that are really important beginning steps that get them on track. Typically, what happens is there's been instruction in the home. Grandma has pointed out, oh, look at that letter is the same as the one there. They're both B. And a little bit of that instruction goes a long way for kids who are getting a lot of exposure to text, having these kinds of discussions over texts, and perhaps having other beneficial things going on as well. So I think there is this kind of idea that there are kids who teach themselves to read. Maybe that's as a scientist, I find that hard to study. I'm not sure what it really means. Often it means there's some kid who's been exposed to a lot of language. There's reading going on in the home. It's not just the kid passively listening to the story. There's discussion around the story. And by the way, the parent is pointing to the words and showing them, demonstrating various things about how print works, which is really crucial. So I do think that is some instruction there that gets the kid off the ground. It's not just a miracle that some kids are so smart they figure out how print works. Perhaps I think that's rare. It's much more likely that, no, you can get a bit of instruction about this in the course of reading, and that's really important. So reading to children, if it's embellished in certain ways, it's important, yes. It usually isn't sufficient. Usually you got to have some additional instruction, which is the kind of thing that should happen in school. So that was the reading to kids part. The other part issue that you raised was about speech. This is really crucial. So before the child gets to school, they've already learned to speak a spoken language. One, maybe two, if there's a bilingual background. Children learn to talk. You know, unless there's some kind of pathology, they're going to learn to talk because there are parents interacting with them, and children are very good language learners and acquire quite a lot by the time they start school. They haven't acquired everything. They understand language at the kindergarten level, but that's enough to really base – that provides a foundation for then learning about reading. So – children are learning about spoken language from birth to entry at school and beyond. Noam Chomsky, who was really the biggest figure in the study of human language and how it's acquired in my lifetime, essentially said that languages are all alike. The capacity to learn language is essentially innate, something that's wired in the child. And the impact of experience is just to set a few little details, you know, about, well, which sounds are actually used and do you put the verb before the noun or after the noun? Some minor number of variables would be set. All that experience is there for is to tell you things like, you know, how you say the word book in the particular language and how book combines with other words. These are thought to be small things. The big things about language are universal, the same, not highly dependent on experience. Well, he wasn't entirely right. What we've learned over the past 30 years or so from studying children's early language experience and what happens in homes around language is that there's a huge amount of variation. Some of it is cultural, you know. There are differences in expectations about parental speech with children. How much interaction is there? Is the child, is it encouraged? How much time is there for such things? How many adults are there in the home who are speaking to the child? These are just real-world factors that influence the child's what kind of language, spoken language, the child is exposed to. So children are learning about spoken language from the speakers around them, and the amount of language that they're being exposed to and the type of language, how complex it is, whether it's a particular dialect, what dialect of English, for example, it is, whether it's intermixed with another language, as in a bilingual home. Children's early experience of spoken language varies enormously. And because Chomsky had pointed at people in the opposite direction, this wasn't discovered until, you know, late 80s, early 90s, and has since been followed up in many, many studies.
Well, I've seen some discussion in your book of how English, learning English, how to read in English differs from how to learn Finnish or a different language. And there's debate that you're discussing in your book, not only with the reading wars, but also about dyslexia. Does it even exist? And what does it mean? We're going to look at that and other issues with reading when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. That's been a big part of teaching reading, but I understand that there have been wars over whether phonics is the main way to teach reading or not. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with my guest Mark Seidenberg, the author of Language at the Speed of Sight, How We Read, Why So Many Can't, and What Can Be Done About It. Can you weigh in on phonics?
Sure. So I'm a scientist who studied reading and language for a very long time. And the word phonics doesn't really figure in how we do things. So if you want to have a theory of how children learn to understand print, words, sentences, texts, we can talk about the various kinds of knowledge that are involved and how that knowledge comes together and how it's acquired. We don't talk about phonics. We will talk about, you know, their spellings and the writing system relates to the spoken language. You can connect those two things up, and then those are indeed connected to the meanings of words and how words are used in context.
Well, let me ask for clarification first, because let's say the word bat, where you've got bat, and then you can rhyme on it with rat, hat, cat, and the whole Dr. Seuss approach. Isn't that phonics?
Well, what I'm trying to get at is that the phonics doesn't have a very clear definition. What people usually mean is rules that will allow you to pronounce written words. And what I'm saying is that in theories of learning to read and reading acquisition, we talk about how those mappings are learned, but it isn't phonics, if you deconstruct it, consists of a lot of things. It's the spellings of words. It's the meanings of words. It's how the spellings represent the sounds and meanings of words. Phonics tends to focus narrowly on one of those issues. How do you pronounce the letters in a word? So it's a term that can be used very loosely, and I think it's important to really examine what it involves. You need to teach kids about spelling and how letters combine. You need to teach them about how the letters represent spoken language, because they already know words from spoken language. That they don't have to relearn language. They're not learning vocabulary all over again. What they're learning is how a different code, how the words they know are represented in this printed code. So you already know things about language. Now you want to give the kid the tool, the ability to go from the printed spellings of words to the knowledge of the words that they already have from speaking and listening. So you need to, yes, the kid needs to learn about this code. How does print relate to the spoken words they already know? That involves a number of moving parts. The generic in education, that's lumped under phonics. And I just want to say, on the one hand, yes, we need to have instruction to help kids catch on to how this system works. It's not a trivial here. Just learn the rules and we'll be done. There's several interacting parts there.
Isn't it true that English is harder than some other languages? That while I was reading your book, I was also, as I always do, reading to my 6-year-old granddaughter and talking to her about language, and she's starting to spell words. And I find myself sometimes embarrassed by English, or because, you know, let's say you have a word like zoo, Z-O-O, and then she spelled clue, C-L-O-O, but it's not. It's C-L-U-E, as in blue. And trying to figure out why there are three spellings of two, you know, and all these things that are wind and wind, or, you know, English is exasperating in many ways when you're trying to teach spelling, is it not?
So I spent a lot of time looking at these issues. Writing systems work different ways. So in Finnish, for example, they have an alphabet, but the number of letters is small, and the correspondences between letters and phonemes, these basic units of a sound like the b and bat, is very consistent, unlike English. They don't have pairs like wind, wind. And so, of course, that part of the system is definitely simpler. And the net result is that by the time a Finnish kid starts school, they'll already know, quote unquote, phonics. They'll know how spelling translates into the sounds of words. And indeed, a 7-year-old Finnish kid can, in principle, sound out almost any word in the language. There's a few little oddballs, but it's highly consistent, and so they can sound out words whose meanings they don't know because they've never – they don't know the words. So that part of the system is definitely easier than English. If you look across writing systems like Finnish and Italian and many Eastern European languages, you find an amazing trade-off. Yes, there are alphabets where the correspondences are simple and direct, much more so than in English. And you could say, why don't we fix English? The answer is that kind of consistency only appears with certain in the writing systems for certain kinds of language. Finnish is really easy to pronounce, get the letter sound correspondences. It has an ungodly complicated system of inflectional morphology. That means it's far more complex than English in terms of the things that have to be added to words for them to be used in sentences. So suffixes, for example, that'll encode the gender of a word, then a number, as in singular or plural, case. A variety of other types of information are represented in the written forms of words. That's the hard part for the person who's learning to read Finnish.
Well, that's true that in English we don't have to do masculine, feminine, and neuter.
We are among the most simple on that. We don't have that stuff. So I actually wrote about this as a kind of universal thing. Namely, there's a trade-off. If you can only have simple and direct spelling phonics, as in Finnish or Italian, in these languages that have complex morphology, it's a trade-off between the complexity of the spoken language and the complexity of the writing system. And the implication is you can't actually use what works for Finnish in English because of the differences between the spoken languages.
And would the answer to why English has such complicated spelling, inconsistent, where you could have H-A-V-E, but it doesn't rhyme with gave... G-A-V-E.
Oh, this is just wonderful stuff, isn't it?
So, is it because of different borrowings from different places and languages? You know, how do you justify or explain, I guess is a better word, how do you explain the fact that so many words in English really don't match up?
Well, Emily, I'm not going to take personal responsibility for the properties of written English here, but there are explanations that are really interesting. So, the first thing I want to just say is the complexity of English is, I think, is exaggerated. So, yeah, we can find examples like wind, wine, but there's only about 13 or 14 of those pairs in English, dive, dove, et cetera. And so those aren't actually a big stumbling block for a kid who's learning to read. In fact, you can avoid them for a long time. But nonetheless, so people look at the individual cases and go have, save, you know, gun, gone, done, you know, bone. Why do they have three ways of pronouncing O and A? Okay. It's for multiple reasons about how the writing system has evolved over many centuries. Here's one of the reasons. English has shorter words, has a higher percentage of short words than in Finnish or Italian or one of these other languages that has a lot of inflection, as I was talking about. So English has a lot of monosyllabic words like the ones we're talking about, have, said, give, done, the. There's several hundred of them. Other languages will not have those little words, or they'll have many fewer. What about for words like have, here's what happened. There was a time when it was pronounced have. But over time, the pronunciations of words change. People are trying to by because of the way that we talk. So people are trying to speak, perform, you know, talking, you know, take an idea and turn it into a spoken utterance under time constraints and so on. Speaking is hard. And what happens among groups of speakers is the language changes in ways to simplify it. We drop things, endings of things, or we shorten vowels because they're easier to pronounce. So words like have start out as have, but in order to produce language more quickly and accurately and maintain a coherent conversation, the pronunciations change. Well, the spellings stay the same. And you end up with a mismatch between the two. That's one big, big source of the inconsistencies. The spoken pronunciation of spoken words is always modifying over long periods of time. Depends on among the communities of speakers. There are various influences that are changing the pronunciations of spoken words. The way we spell them has to stay the same. You can't keep changing the spellings. If we're going to maintain communication.
So you just put up with all the silent letters, like in the kind of knight that rhymes that rides on a horse, with the KN and the GH that don't get pronounced. You just kind of keep all those silent letters that are in cough with the GH that doesn't make it look like coffee. There's so many times where there are these silent letters that have to be there for reading or writing.
You know, it's true, and some of them seemed one of the ideas that will never go away is language reform, that people – we should just have a conference and let's change how written English is done. We could get rid of all of these inconsistencies. And the answer to that is no, you can't. That would be a disaster. The spellings of words are giving you clues about words that are related to one another, even if their pronunciations aren't exactly the same. So if you have photo and photograph and photographer, there are differences in the pronunciation there of some of those parts. But you can still tell from the written form that those are related. Those are related words. If you start changing the pronunciations of words to be consistent, you will lose the information about the words that are related. So reforming the written language is hopeless. One could look at the system and try to, as I said before, I don't think it's actually as horrible as it seems, especially for a beginning reader, if we group the words correctly and kind of build on our understanding of how children and humans pick up on patterns. So yeah, have looks terrible if you compare it to save and gave. It doesn't look so terrible if you look compare it to have and give and dove. There are a number of these words in which the vowel has gotten shortened, and that's where the pattern is.
So your approach to teaching reading, as opposed to sort of thinking either of phonics or avoiding phonics and doing sort of looking at pictures and balanced literacy, so your approach would be to look especially at patterns and kind of approach it that way. I wanted to ask you, too, about dyslexia, because you spent a couple chapters talking about it and even raising the question, does it exist? I did see a film called The Truth About Reading where somebody that was interviewed said there is no such thing as dyslexia. It's really dysteachia, that is just reading not being taught right. But I know people who are brilliant in math and struggle with the spelling of basic words and with letters flipping.
Well, those people who say that dyslexia is just an excuse for poor teaching, I know the history of that idea. I think it is a pernicious falsehood, and that creates real obstacles for the parents of children who have children who are struggling with reading, probably because of a condition that is interfering with being able to learn. So I find those statements utterly false and contradicted by vast amounts of research and reprehensible, and they are indeed being repeated to this day. I can explain how that came about. So let's say you got a 4 or 5 year old, 6 year old who, and you, at that age, you kind of was beginning to expect them to catch on, to indicate that they're catching on to things about letters and they have sounds and maybe they're figuring out some things about two words that start with the same sound, and you can see it then in the letters. They're starting to pick up on some of these properties. And then you have kids who are not. And then they go to kindergarten, first grade, second grade, and there are these kids who are behind in reading. And the question is why. So if these early problems are apparent in kids who are in kindergarten, first grade, second grade, those kids, we now want to know what's the cause of their difficulty so that we can address it. If you're dealing with a kid in that age range, we can't really definitively say, you're dyslexic. It's a condition that emerges over time. You can't really know whether the kid is dyslexic until too late, until they're older. What you want to do is look at kids who are struggling, whether it's for dyslexia or because of dyslexia or some other situation, and intervene with them to keep them from going off the rails. Now, here's the problem. About three decades ago, a woman named Mari Clay from New Zealand, who became a very influential figure in this country and elsewhere, said, you know, many children are identified as dyslexic, but it's really because they didn't learn to read. They weren't taught correctly. And there is an element of truth to that. So when I studied dyslexic kids or kids who were struggling to read, they would fit the pattern of children who would later turn out to be dyslexics. Behaviorally, they would look like kids who were dyslexic, but actually they were what we called, you know, they were instructional victims. They were instructional dyslexics. They hadn't been taught the relevant things. You know, you can't sound out words if you haven't been taught how to sound out words.
So that's the dysteichia thing that somebody was talking about on the film.
Yeah, but Clay said, so that means that some kids who are being identified as dyslexic are actually just kids who need to be taught better. And that will always be true. There are kids who are not being taught well, and they need to be taught better. However, her followers rounded this up to saying, there is no dyslexia. All reading problems are because children haven't been taught correctly. And that is false. There are children who will struggle even when instruction is optimal. And the people who say, we could teach every child to read if we only did it correctly, were people like Richard Allington, a huge figure in education who was a dyslexia denialist. This has had just reprehensible sorts of effects on kids and their parents.
We're going to talk more about what to do about the problem when we continue a moment with University of the Year. Once you learn to read, you will be forever free. So said Frederick Douglass. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Mark Seidenberg. We are talking about Beyond the Reading Wars to the Science of Reading. We know we have a huge problem in the terms of the number of children and adults unable to read. We know that children who do not learn to read are more likely to end up in prison. It is a huge problem. So let's spend the last few minutes here talking about what can we do. You know, imagine that you have the ears of all the parents and grandparents and teachers and legislators. They're all listening. They all recognize, hey, we have a terrible problem here. We want better outcomes. What would you say to them to do?
Well, the first thing I would say is that there's an enormous amount that we can do. And so we should be optimistic about the possibility of change. There's a lot to build on. And there are people who are well-meaning and recognize that these are important issues. Now, what in practice can be done? Look, it's a big educational, you know, cultural, corporate structure government structure we're trying to change. And so change is hard to achieve. Ideally, what kinds of things could we do? One thing that's important to recognize is many children struggle with reading, but their problems aren't really about reading per se. It's not really about print. Print is the part that's really unique about reading. And people naturally think, well, if the kid's not reading well, it must be about print. often, I would say in most cases, the problems arise from children's command of things that reading builds on. In particular, success in reading depends on your knowledge of language. There are obvious things like vocabulary, and there are other things like, you know, what kinds of grammatical structures you're familiar with or capable of understanding. So there are huge differences in spoken language. Particularly, you know, kids' knowledge of the language that will be used in school, like, for example, in the books. So if children differ in terms of where they are on the path to reading on the first day of kindergarten, we need to be thinking about their spoken language experience before they get there. This doesn't mean prescribing that parents interact with their children differently. Something I think you cannot ask parents to do. We need to find ways of exposing children to a wider range of language, spoken language, before they get to school, particularly emphasizing the kind of language that they need to benefit from instruction. So, spoken language differences. We are not trying to reprogram how children talk in the home to their parents in the home particularly. It's nice if the parents are on board, but what's more important is, for example, pre-K, a pre-K that emphasizes language, where, for example, children would be able to see staff members who model language for them and indeed may have different language backgrounds or accents.
So universal,
communicate with one another and demonstrate to children how language works. And children, of course, are very good at learning this without direct instruction. You know, so we want to have a lot more spoken language washed over those kids so that they're better on an equal footing when they get to school. That's the first thing.
So universal pre-K, kind of the Head Start approach, but even earlier than some of the beginnings?
Not exactly. So most states now are implementing some kind of pre-K. And when people look at the reading problems that we've been talking about, they say, well, we need to start teaching reading in pre-K. No, that's missing the point. I just said most of these kids' issues are not about reading. They're about the enabling kinds of knowledge. They're about your knowledge of language and your knowledge of what we use language to talk about, like the world, like topics that are going to be relevant in school. So it's not starting at a younger age. It's taking kids who are in pre-K and having a language focus there.
Spoken language. So children would learn more. And then let's say they're in the classroom now and you have a teacher who's going to teach them how to read. How is that approach to teaching reading going to be different?
Two things there. One is, just to continue the spoken language issue, kids get to school, and in many classrooms, spoken language opportunities to learn more about spoken language are limited. I've seen and been in many classrooms in which children only speak in response to queries from teachers. They are not encouraged to talk back and forth with teachers. There's very little conversation. They're supposed to be silent when they go to the bathroom or at recess. There's an emphasis on quiet and the teacher teaching the kid to read. School should also continue to be an environment in which children's spoken language is expanding. Now, if we deal with the spoken language issues, then there's the part about print. We need to do a better job in terms of how kids are taught about print. Unfortunately, very little research about learning has found its way into curricula yet. The goal is children need to learn some basic skills. This is kind of the mechanics of reading. We want to get that stuff. We want to get in, get out, and move on. We want to get those kids to catch on to how the system works so that they can start to benefit from reading more and more on their own with less and less supervision. So, yes, we need to do instruction related to print and how it relates to spoken language. We have not done this adequately in the past, and now people are struggling. They recognize the need, and they are We are working towards methods for doing these things that are as efficient as possible, that are as effective as possible, and that are equitable. They work with children from different backgrounds.
So the classic primer, you know, the Dick and Jane type from long ago, or the kind of the beginning readers, anything wrong with them?
Well, I grew up on Dick and Jane. I like Dick and Jane, but the pictures, the watercolors were really nice. Of course, they're totally inadequate in this era. The curricula that are used to teach children to read are part of the problem. We are trying to move to the field, I think, is looking forward to ways of doing things better. The challenge, of course, is you want to get children into reading, not just, you know, the phonics rules or something technical, how you pronounce the silent E rule or other things like that. We want them to get into reading, understanding texts, being able to ask questions about it, and so on. The curricula that we have are very helpful to teachers. They include many different possible ways of teaching kids to read. People are trying to introduce texts that are readable, that kids can, you know, if they're progressing, they'll be able to read. We want kids to get into reading books. Yes, it's challenging, right? Because they have to be interesting. They have to be about topics that kids care about. I've worked with publishers and I look at the materials they present and they're so dull. Why couldn't they be about sports or music or food or other things that kids really care about? I do think it's challenging. I think we can do a lot better. And of course, the recent developments in AI are going to have a huge impact here, because it is within our grasp to say, write me a text that's appropriate for a first grade reader that's about soccer and doesn't use the words X, Y, and Z, you know, to kind of not and have those things generated much more rapidly and possibly yielding more natural texts. So, they're in the classroom. We need to be teaching the basic skills in a way that is efficient. We want to get this done. There's only a limited amount of time per instruction, and the clock is ticking. So get in, teach what is necessary in order to enable the kid to do more learning on their own, because they can build on their skills, and bring them into materials that are they can learn from, that are about topics, that are about animal habitats, or spicy foods, or other things that, you know, they might want to know about. So there's a lot to work on and a lot to change, and there are a lot of entrenched stakeholders here. So trying to move this forward is proving to be enormously challenging. At least now there's growing recognition of the acute need.
And perhaps mobilizing an army of volunteers to help tutor, help read, help be in the schools to work with children wherever they are in their journey toward reading. I'm Emily Auerbach. My guest has been Mark Seidenberg. Thank you for joining me, Mark. That's been illuminating.
Thanks.
I hope you can join me for the next hour of University of the Year.